So the question was asked basically to understand how the kippah struga evolved and understanding why it connotes such a difference within Israeli culture and represents the, call it the Zionist movement or the Tilumi movement. And I think that before we get there, we have to begin with halacha and then evolve into cultural differences, just so we have things straight and we don't spend our time just wondering about how society works. We also understand how society should work. The Gemara brings that there was a rabbi who was running to bring his kid to the class, and he had a towel on his head. So he met up with a friend of his, and he said, "Hey, what's with the towel?" So he said, "Well, you got to cover your head. God doesn't like when people walk around with their head uncovered. It's a sign of modesty. It's a sign of recognition that God's running the world." And from that Gemara, we infer that we understand that in those times, it wasn't accepted. You see that his counterpart, who was also a rabbi, was wondering, what's he doing covering his head that way? So the concept of kippah was instituted by the rabbis as a custom, and it became accepted in most of Israel. And today, almost all Jews have this custom to wear a kippah. And it also became a sign of a difference between whether you're Jewish or not Jewish, so as that if one walks without a kippah today, in the areas where it's customary for Jews to wear a kippah, he may also be violating the biblical transgression of not doing things which follows the ways of the non-Jews. Right? So the institution began as a custom, and initially it was a custom for the pious. And as it evolved over the centuries, it became accepted. And in most communities, I mean, there are still Halabi communities where they only wear kippah for prayer and for making blessings, which was initially the institution. Initially, people only had to cover their head for making blessings and prayer. And then people covered their head. They wouldn't walk 4 footsteps without covering their head, and that's the way it is today, and that's what we have to do today. That's our custom. And it's not only rabbinic, it's also, according to some opinions, biblical, because today that it's so accepted, taking off a kippah, walking around with one's head uncovered, is, so to speak, going in the ways of... No, I didn't say that. I said that it's going in the ways of the non-Jews, and we're in things that the Jews have accepted, something that's pious, and the non-Jews don't do it, one is not allowed to break the code, so to speak. It's not allowed to be like them. So that, now, what does one cover his head with? There's a famous tshuva to the Marshal. A Jew in Germany says, you know, it's very complicated for me to sit here and learn. With a head covering, I can't concentrate on my learning. So the Marshal writes him a whole tshuva. The Marshal, just historically, he was a contemporary of the Rama. And there are correspondences between him and the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles. He was a great, great rabbi who argued on the Rama. There are many arguments between them. So the Marshal writes to him, explaining to him that really it's not a must, it's just a custom, and that in their generation it wasn't yet as widespread a custom. And then the Marshal tells him, look, but people around you aren't going to treat you nicely if they see you walking around without a kippah or learning without a kippah, so find yourself some kind of material that's light, that you won't feel that it's on your head. Cut yourself a circle of that material, put it on your head, and you'll have a head covering. The Chafetz Chaim couldn't afford a hat the way people today wear hats. He wore a little casket. You know, like the peddlers. That's what he wore as a hat.
He didn't even have a beard anymore.
He couldn't grow a good beard. He had a beard, but not like the pictures. The pictures is a picture of his butcher. When he had to go get a picture taken for his passport, so he couldn't make it, they sent the butcher to get his picture taken, and that's the picture from his passport. That's what Rabbi Wein says. The picture on all the books that shows a glowing face, that was the shochet
so
in town.
He made the glue, then.
So after World War II, and especially in the last 20 years, things started evolving. And suddenly, we find ourselves in the last 20 years where a yeshiva student, in most yeshivas, at least what's called the black hat yeshivas, is going to wear only black hat and is only going to wear a white shirt. Now, back in Europe, if you wore a black hat, so you had to be a rabbi. Otherwise, they'd look at you and say, hey, who are you? What are you doing wearing a black hat? So today we're all rabbis, but we're not all rabbis. But as the world evolved, so things have gone to the extreme. And today what's accepted in one society is that you wear what they call black and whites, right? Black yarmulke, a white shirt, black or blue pants, a black hat, a black jacket. But this is a social norm. This isn't halacha. It's a social norm in that society. The truth is that what was accepted throughout Judaism in most of the world was that people wore this kind of yarmulke, some kind of black yarmulke. That's what was accepted. People came to Israel, and there was the movement of establishing our presence in the land, cultivating the land, and people wanted a sign of the time, so to speak. They wanted a nicer kippah. They wanted something that's handmade, that they put their own efforts into. And so people started making knitted yarmulkes. And people started looking at knitted yarmulkes as nicer. What people don't know is that Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, and this was quoted by Rav Aviner in an article about 6 years ago in Ateret Kohanim, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, was against the knitted yarmulkes. And why? Because he said, by wearing a knitted yarmulke, what you're doing is you're causing divisiveness within the nation. Now, if I walk into yeshiva and I wear a knitted yarmulke, so they look at me and they say, oh, you're one of the tzionim. Whereas if you wear a black yarmulke, so you could be everything. But that's not so accurate anymore. Because if you wear a black yarmulke, so people assume you're not going to do the army, and you don't believe in the state, and you don't pay your taxes. That's a situation in the country. That's a social norm. You could say it's right, you could say it's wrong. It happens to be wrong. But that's irrelevant. The fact of the matter is, when you walk somewhere, just like the fact that you wear a kippah makes a statement, and if you're going to wear a t-shirt that says gratefully dead, you're saying a statement. And if you're going to wear a button-down shirt, then you're making a different statement. And none of these statements are necessarily true. But when people look at you, they do evaluate you by the clothing you wear and the haircut you have, or the ponytail you have. People will evaluate you by that, whether it's right or wrong. By the same token, the kippah has come to symbolize a political statement in this country, in Israel. And in Chutz Lartz, it's a little different depending on the country you live in. But in Israel, that's what it means. Now, the fact that it's wrong, that the Torah forbids divisiveness within Judaism, the Torah says, Lo tisgodudu, which our sages interpreted to mean you're not allowed to have factions within Judaism. We could have different opinions, but within one city, everyone has to have the same customs. We all have to go according to one court. We're not allowed to have this divisiveness. It's wrong that the kippah has come to mean I'm part of this group and you're part of that group and we do different things. It's not the way it should be. But at the end of the day, that's the way it is. And the person can stand on the rooftop and yell, it's wrong, it's wrong, it's wrong, and he'll be right. But that won't make the facts in when you have to deal with people any different. The fact of the matter is that people do judge you by what you wear. And if you walk with a black kippah, then everyone's assuming you don't serve in the army, you don't believe in the army, you don't believe in the state. Whether it's right or wrong is irrelevant. When I was dating, so people came to me and said, you should know we're having a lot of trouble setting you up. So I said, okay, why? So they said, well, we want to set you up with a girl who wants a guy in Merkaz Harav. She hears you wear a hat and a black kippah, she doesn't want you. We want to set you up with a girl that wants a hat and a black kippah. She hears you're in Merkaz Harav. She doesn't want you. So you got to choose which way you're going to go. So I said, well, the way I'm going is a black kippah in Merkaz Harav. So that worked for about 2 years. And after about 2 or 3 years of not getting too many offers, I decided, forget it. Go fight City Hall. This is the way people are thinking. I don't want my wife to think that way because it's not the way I think. That's not what I think is right halachically. But that's the way the world runs. So I took off my black kippah and put on a knitted yarmulke. And ended up meeting up with a girl who always wanted a guy with a black kippah in Merkaz Harav, marrying her. But shows you how much people know. But at some point, you can't fight everyone. And what was interesting to me was that even family members and people who were close to me treated me totally differently the second I switched kippah. So long as I was wearing a black kippah, they always spoke about me, even in front of me, as a given that I would never do the army, and I didn't believe in the army. And then I switched kippah, and they hadn't yet ever spoken a word to me about what my belief system is, and now they quoted me as being of the thought of the school that believes that you must do army, and it's very important to army, and I had never said a word, not this way, not that way. But people do assume it, and they assume it so much that they're willing to say this is what you believe. So, in a nutshell, what we said is, halachically, we Ashkenazim and most Sephardim have to cover our head. What we cover our head with is irrelevant so long as it's the size of a vessel. I mean, it can't be something tiny that's like a bobby pin. You can't say, well, I'm wearing a bobby pin in my head, that's my head covering. It's got to be a size that's considered a garment. Now, that doesn't, some say it has to be big enough that at any side you look at a person, you could see he's wearing kippah. Rabbi Feinstein didn't hold that. Rabbi Feinstein held that a kippah that's big enough that it's considered a garment is a kippah. Now, we don't say, well, you have to make sure whatever side people look at you, they see a kippah, or others say it has to be big enough that it's covering most of your head. Rabbi Feinstein didn't hold of that. There are those that do hold of that. So I'm just preparing you for if people come talk to you and tell you, well, you got to wear a kippah like this or a kippah like that. So you should know there are such opinions, but there are other opinions. And today, even though halachically it still makes no difference what kind of kippah you're wearing, socially people do assume things depending on the kippah you wear. One second, did we cover your question though?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is another one?
No. It's
totally same thing? Okay.
A little comment to it. So basically all of that is basically hatred against other Jews for what they wear. Like you just said, like they were classifying you, they were like judging you. So it's like baseless hatred just because they wear a different kippah.
Let me tell you something that someone else said. This is a quote. I don't remember who said it. Right, I should hang that up again. I have a paper about Mashiach's hat. Did you see it, David?
You told a story about he went to each different shul, and like he said,
I hung it up. No,
Right.
Okay, so I'll try to remember to post it again. A woman is walking down an alley, and it's 2:00 in the morning, and there's silence. And as she's walking down the alley, she looks down the alley and sees a huge figure filling up the alley. And she can't see, there's a light behind him. She doesn't know whether to turn around and run, what she should do. And for a second, her heart stops. And then, the lighting gets better, and she sees it's a guy, a frum guy with a hat and a jacket and a long beard. And she smiles and walks on. So this was said to, and this example was given to someone who was speaking badly about the Jews in the time of the riots in New York. So one of the African Americans was speaking badly about the Jews. So one of the Jews said to her on the news, he said, "Tell me, miss, if you were that woman standing in the alleyway at 2:00 in the morning, and as the light changed, like you could see who it was, and you saw it was a fellow African American, what would you do? And if you saw it was a Jew with a beard and a hat, what would you do?" That's what he said to her. You know. But I think that we have to think, wait a second, but if our clothes do represent who we are, we could say it's baseless from today until tomorrow. You dress a certain way, people judge you. And today, a yarmulke is part of that. Right or wrong is irrelevant. And to keep saying, well, people are wrong, so that's like me spending 2 years dating and saying, I won't switch kippah, that's who I am. So, okay, you could do that. The question is, are you gaining anything? It's very difficult to change. We don't necessarily have to change, but we have to think whether it's right to look outwardly the way we're used to. To change ourselves, you don't want to change your kippah, fine. But to say, well, everyone else is wrong, that's the social norm. And because that's the social norm, so everyone that comes here knows that they have to do that. So everyone else abides by the social norm, so the social norm becomes a truth. It's not only a social norm today, it's a truth on the most part. So to stand and say, no, it's a lie, it's wrong, but it's becoming a truth. You with me?
Yeah. Maybe point even in the black kippah. The Sephardim that came here, it was also imposed as a norm. They also had to change their mode of dress, and this has happened throughout the ages in Europe too. So now that we've reached that even the Haredi world, everybody dressed in the same, that wasn't also 50 years ago.
Right, but it was communities. If you lived in Europe where it was cold, you wore a suit, you wore stuff that were warmer. you lived out in Arab countries in the Middle East, so you wore a robe, which was cooler. It made sense. Today it has nothing to do with what makes sense. No one using his intellect would choose this kind of garb to wear in this country. Maybe in the middle of the winter, but not in the middle of the summer. You wouldn't wear a black felt hat in the middle of the summer. That's not something someone would choose. Yeah, because they're maintaining a certain dress code. But it has nothing to do with what used to define the dress code. Going back 100 years, that's when people would dress based on what made sense. Today, we're going by a dress code. But the whole world does.
So, isn't it up to people sometimes perhaps to make a statement?
What do you mean?
Perhaps for a later period. Because if you have a trend where these rules are broken down, slowly. And people return perhaps if we are trying, we are following, we're saying that this is something not ideal, but we'll anyway do it because other people do it. So it's going to put us in a certain spotlight or a certain negative, like other people have a negative perception against it. So isn't perhaps for people to make a statement and slowly we'll evolve, because we are a sum of people, so the more.
The question is, what price you pay and what chance you have at success.
The short term and the long term.
Does it depend?
Right.
The short term, maybe we take a hit, but like, I don't know, I'm almost agreeing with them a little bit. I mean, like, if you get a number of people to do it, like a number of Zionist people to...
It already represents a trend. I'm saying people to the taste of what they're...
In many respects, I would agree with you, except... And here's the big except. There's a tendency that when people either do tshuva or do gear, so when they enter a system, they automatically see the faults of the system. That's the first thing that happens. When I first learned to be a mohel, so every mohel I saw, I had things that I thought he's not doing well. Because when you're new to something, so you're looking with critique at everyone. You don't know to appreciate the good. But you do know to say, wait, this is off, and that's off, and the other thing's off. And it's more difficult to swallow because you've joined something because you believe in it. And suddenly you see, wait a second, there's a lot of foolishness within this. It's not all good. It's not all the way it should be. Even there's even hypocrisy within here. I mean, there are people who are saying this and doing that, and et cetera. There are a few modes of behavior which a person can adopt once that happens. Person can say, forget it, I'm leaving. A person can say, I'll swallow it, it'll pass, it's not so important. Or a person can say, I'll try to change it. I think that most people who do tshuva or do gear, and I say most modestly, I would say 99.99999%, and try to change things like this, lose. They don't succeed in changing. And they succeed in having the world look at them and say, ah, that's a Baal Tshuva, he's doing things weirdly. And they're right. It's not a pleasant thing to hear, but they're right, because ask yourself, how many things need fixing within society? Should this be number one?
Absolutely.
I don't think this should be number one. I mean, I could tell you a lot of other things that I would put higher up than this.
But a lot of things that require fixing take a lot more effort.
This the question is, what price are you paying and what effort are you putting in here?
This is not something that retracts from your effort towards other things.
That's where you might be wrong. You see, I paid a price when it came to Shiduchim. So I'm lucky I'm married today. But no one guaranteed me that would work. You see, at some point I caved in. Right or wrong, I said, hey, it ain't working. It's not like there isn't a price. People do look, and the question is, are you moving them, or are you being moved? So you're being moved out of the norm. And one of the things that I keep saying in our Binyan HaBayit class, don't try to be original. If you could build a home that represents a normal Jewish home, you're a tremendous success. Most Baal Yeshuva don't succeed in it. There's an unfortunate large statistic of people who do Yeshuva who fail in building their homes. Oh no, I'm coming to scare you, but I have two choices. I can ignore the facts or present you with the facts and tell you try to tell you the things which I think are going to be conducive to succeeding. Now, one of them is don't try to fight Tzedi Hu. This is a mistake which I think many people make. A lot of people who do tshuva say, and there's a lot of logic to it, they say, if what I'm doing is right, why should I conform to the norm? I'm conforming with everything else in my life to what the halacha says. Where I don't have to conform, I don't want to conform. Now, I understand that. And I could even add to that. If someone did tshuva, then that means he has a personality. He's willing to change things in his life. Well, if he has a personality, then he's not a pushover. Then it's harder to swallow when people tell him to do something which has no halachic basis and might even be wrong, such as this thing.
What would be some sacrifices? I mean, you have a bunch of people walking around with black definition anyway. It's not like you're going
to
stand up.
Right, but are you going to join them? Where are you going to be philosophically? If you're going to try joining them, they're going
to
look at you and say, wait a second, but you don't agree with us philosophically. I doubt it. He's going
to
quote you 100 sources. You won't know what he's misquoting, how he's quoting. So you think you're going to succeed? He'll tell you, all the rabbis say like this. Or what about all these rabbis that do like this? And why don't you see the rabbis saying and doing what you're saying? I could tell you, when I was in America as a rab, parenthetically, so one of the rabbis came to me after prayer one day, and he said, you should know, I noticed you're here with a hat and jacket and a kippah. Keep it up, don't cave in. One of the rabbis in America is a rabbi. He said, you're right, and maybe like you're saying, you'll push other people over. Don't cave in, even though it's uncomfortable, you're the only one here doing it, don't give in. Okay. I'm not saying you shouldn't cave in. What's the price you're paying? If you're being ostracized, even though you're not technically being ostracized, but you're not joining society, so then you lost.
But how is this society if it's only a couple of yeshivas? It's half and half, it seems like.
If you're going to join the other society, fine. But if you're going to philosophically... Oh, that's the way the world should be. When people ask me, that's what I answer when people ask me.
Why should I confine into that home here, start wearing kippah, sugah, and all this stuff? And I'm Jewish. I like to, you know, go everywhere.
So this leads us to another discussion. Wait. Technically, you're right. Technically, we're all Jewish. When people ask me, are you Dati Lumi or Haredi? And guys, you're asking me this all the time. I say, I'm Jewish. I like everyone. And I hope everyone likes me. I hope. thank you. But it doesn't work that way, and I'll tell you why. Imagine a guy sends his children to the army. He spends 3 years when he knows his kids are on the front line. Every time he hears a soldier's been hit, so he runs to the newspaper and he waits to hear who that is, and he doesn't know if that's his child. That's a very, very difficult way to live one's life. At the same time that he's sending his child to the front lines, someone else is saying, you guys, you're lowlifes. Tzioinim, like I had a guy tell me today, what? Mizrochnikim, you guys, what are you giving up your lives for? The Medina is all crooked, it's not according to halacha. What are you risking your lives for? What are you giving up your lives for? And, fine, but this is I'm just saying what the other side's going to say, but this is a government that's been trampling on the Torah and been trying to institute things that are against the Torah. So you're sending your son to the front lines to do that. My son's in yeshiva learning Torah, and I... One second. We're not going to that discussion yet. I'm just saying, he went on to the next question. Well, how come things are so polarized? So I'm saying, even though technically you're right, things shouldn't be so polarized, but when you have a situation that one person is risking his life and the other person is saying, you shouldn't even be putting in a cent into this, so things are going to be polarized. We're both Jewish, and I'll try to help you where I can, but at the same time, this difference in a, call it hashkafa, call it in halacha, call it in philosophy, however you want to define it, but this difference, which has tremendous practical ramifications, is going to cause that both sides are distant from one another. You with me? Mm-hmm. So even though you might be right, technically, we're all Jewish, and when people ask me, what are you? I say, I'm Jewish. And I don't enter this game of quantifying he's this and I'm that. But at the same time, we have to understand that there are lives at stake here. And the argument is an argument of blood. It's not just an argument of, am I going to buy Israeli bonds or not buy Israeli bonds? It's an argument of, where am I going to put my life online? Where am I going to put my children's life online? So the Haredi feels, hey, you're supporting a government that's trying to kill us. This is all wrong. What are you guys doing? And the other guy says, the Tilumi says, you guys aren't investing and you're reaping the benefits. And the quick answer to that is the Haredi says, what do you mean? I'm also investing. I pay 17% on everything I buy. Anytime you go to the Makot, it's not like I'm not paying taxes. If I'm forced to pay the taxes here, so then I should at least be entitled to get something from it. I'm paying the taxes on everything I do. So you can't say I'm not paying.
There's a difference between sending your children to the front and sending them to the yeshiva.
So that's a different discussion if you want, but that could be the next question. We've already evolved in this one very far. Yeah.
A lot of people that I talk to about, like, Haredi to say about the military, they say, this is like a lot of the answers I've heard, that in studying yeshiva is guiding the bullet that the soldier is going to shoot to kill the enemy.
Oh,
and
so that's...
And that's what keeps the Israeli soldiers so great, is them learning in yeshiva also, so it's a combined combination.
That's our chapter in Tehillim tonight. Bezrat Hashem, if we get to it, that's our chapter in Tehillim discusses that concept. We do believe that. We do believe that Hashem, when He judges the Jewish people, He judges us as a whole. And the fact that you have people learning Torah and davening is not less important, at least not less important, and according to the Gemara, even more important than the fact that you have people on the front lines. But that needs discussion. Again, taking something from concept to practical ramifications needs discussion.
But why would you also want a soldier that doesn't want to fight?
So again, that one second, that's already, we're evolving. So let's first see if Everett wants that question. Or
I know if I'm a squad leader, I would want people that don't want to be on there.
Did you want to say something?
No,
Ryan.
Frank, please, yeah.
I'm with you, yeah.
No, use the effort.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Ephraim, I'm with you. Ah,